Classic arms-folded New York stance.
Gideon Yeago.
It wasn't like suddenly the heavens had opened.
Jenny Eliscu. But I love them immediately.
Rob Sheffield.
Moldy Peaches opened. Kimya was in the sheep suit, and Adam was in his little Robin Hood outfit. It was really, really good. They were fantastic. Adam Green.
I was jealous because the Mercury Lounge gave the Strokes beer, and for me that meant they had made it. They bought them beer.
Rob Sheffield.
So then the Strokes came out. People playing the Mercury Lounge had to walk through the crowd. Usually they would be very hesitant, trying to make a discreet entrance, as if they knew they looked a little silly. I'd never seen a band walk through Mercury Lounge like they did this on purpose, like they did this every show. But the Strokes turned that into their entrance, just walking right through the crowd with their guitars above their heads.
Fabrizio Moretti.
That was one time I remember feeling really cool, walking through one of the sold-out Mercury Lounge nights. From the front of the place to the fucking stage, they were just there to see us. It was the first time I felt like I was looked at, and it felt really good. That was also the last time it felt good.
Rob Sheffield.
And then they were phenomenal. They were absolutely fucking great. They were so into it. They were so passionate. Like, people would talk about them in print as being jaded or remote, but that's the opposite of how the music sounded. It was very enthusiastic, very gung-ho, very boyish, very sexual. There was this great part where Julian was looking at the crowd while they were playing last night, and says to someone in the front row, "Don't fucking yawn." It was really funny. I loved the idea of a band where if you were standing in the crowd and you were yawning, you were a target.
Mark Spitz.
Julian wanted the shows to be good, as a proud, hard-working musician, not as a rock star. It wasn't a party. It was more like a track meet, something he felt like he was training for.
Adam Green.
Those shows had an element of hysteria to them, which was cool because I hadn't seen that yet. For any of the bands that were my age, I hadn't gone to a show where people were genuinely losing their minds.
Anthony Rossomando.
It was almost like they paid everyone to freak out. There were all these models there. It was ridiculous.
Rob Sheffield.
They were trying. It wasn't cool to try. They were really vain and very preening. They were very funny. They had a real sense of humor about themselves on stage, playing this role that they enjoyed and that they knew was ridiculous. They actually wanted to be rock stars, and they acted like rock stars. It's like Richard Hell said about the New York Dolls. They saw themselves as stars first and musicians second. Nobody would have cared if the Strokes didn't have the songs, but they did.
Gideon Yeago.
I do remember thinking, this band is really tight. Coming just after grunge, where the emphasis was on the distortion pedal and just let one sound bleed into the other sound, these guys cut chord changes and moments in the songs into each other. Everybody talks about Television, but I kept thinking about the Buzzcocks. It was party music. It wasn't mopey music. It was dance music.
Anthony Rossomando.
Those guys got it together quick. It was inspiring, like, 2.5-minute songs. One idea, song done. Another idea. It was like, duh.
Jim Merlis.
You have to remember what other music was around at the time. There was nothing.
Ryan Gentles.
Jim Merlis was one of the people I sent the demo to. He pulled me aside after the first Mercury Lounge show and said, "I'm in."
Jim Merlis.
It was so funny, because before the show, I was Mr. Cool. I don't know if you need a publicist. And after, I was suddenly saying, "We need to meet really quickly."
Jenny Eliscu. Having Jim Merlis on their team meant something. He'd been Nirvana's publicist.
Jim Merlis.
I think the show was on a Friday, and on Monday we had our first meeting at 2A.
The other interesting thing about that meeting was that Juliet Jocelyn, now Casablancas, was the bartender downstairs at 2A. So the first night I met both of them was the night they met. She and Ryan went to college together. Ryan Gentles. I was an RA, and her roommate was a klepto. We became friends. She was obviously into music. She looked cool. We never had any type of sexual relationship, not a kiss or a cuddle, anything. We were just buds instantly. When I started working with this band, I told her I needed help. She was still in college, but she'd help me part-time between classes. And then she dropped out when the band got more popular, and I was able to pay her a salary. And after that, she got a raise. Then she met Julian and got another raise. Jim Merlis. Max Tepper, who worked in our office. He knew about the Strokes, but he hadn't told me about them. He was tough, hated everything. Max said, "I hear that guy's an asshole," about Julian. After the show, I said, "Quite frankly, I don't really care."
Jenny Eliskew. I was the right age to appreciate it because I didn't feel any resentment about them being the same age as me. I just thought the music was fucking cool. I mean, there were presentation elements that needed work. It has always been true that Julian is both trying way too hard and really just not trying at all. But I could see the vibe they were going for, either intentionally or unintentionally, and it was cool.
Jim Merlis. They didn't exactly do what Nirvana did to hair bands, but those Limp Bizkit bands did become kind of obsolete around that time. Punk rock had morphed more into that Green Day-ish thing, which has nothing to do with CBGBs in 1977. Jenny Eliskew kept saying to the band, "You don't understand, there's not been something good in New York in decades. Decades." It was the return of the rock stars. Ryan Gentles. Jim Merlis said, "I'll do this for free, they're so good. They're going to get a deal. I'll do it until you get the deal and we'll just work it out." I was like, great. This guy at Rough Trade in England is going to put the record out.
Chapter 23. Shit, I'll be in that band. Jaleel Bunton. The reason you grow up wanting to be a rock star is because you're like, "I don't know how to communicate so well. And if I could just make this fucking song, I don't have to." Paul Banks. Some of my dissatisfaction with life started with seeing a really beautiful girl, and having this unbelievable longing and sense of sadness about the lack of connection, or the lack of awareness of my existence. So what I would do, the only thing that would keep me in my own skin, would be to say, "Well, I'm going to make something so fucking good that I'm worthy of that thing that I lust after." If I got everything I wanted from girls, I wouldn't write shit. Daniel Kessler. I remember the first time I heard Paul sing. It was amazing. Paul Banks. I started playing guitar when I was 13, 14. By 15, I'd tell guidance counselors when they asked, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to be a rock star." Daniel Kessler. At that time, before Sam joined, it was Carlos, our original drummer, and me. We had already been playing, so we had songs. We had an early version of PDA, and maybe Roland. Paul Banks. My feeling was, okay, I'm not looking to be in a band. But I walked into a room, and Daniel and Carlos were playing PDA, and it was shit, I'll be in that band. Daniel Kessler. Early on, I'd been singing a lot more than him. Paul was still finding his place. He wasn't even sure if he was going to stay in the band. Paul Banks. I quit after a couple months because my ego was annoyed that I wasn't writing songs, that I was only going to be a guitar player. I remember I played him one of his own songs and said, "If you can write that, you don't really need me. That's all the talent in the world right here. Just do your thing. I'll do my thing." Before Interpol, I had a song where I sang, "There are no pretty girls." I did that in my apartment in 96. The chorus was the sound my phone made when I took it off the receiver for a while.
I was experiencing very deep depressions at that age.
Daniel Kessler. I called him up and I was like, wait a minute. What if you come back and you sing? Then Carlos and I went to the smallest room at Funkadelic Studios. We were playing a very slow, ambient piece of music. And all of a sudden, Paul started singing. And we were like, what the fuck? He can really sing.
Paul Banks. I had sung before. And this is the fascinating part about being in a band. I was of the Elliott Smith four-track home recording school. But my quiet delivery wouldn't float the boat with the drummer in that small concrete room. So my vocal style from the early days developed based on me shouting my own lyrics so they would be audible over the drums.
Daniel Kessler.
That day we heard Paul sing, we really knew. There were a couple of moments like that in the band. The first rehearsal with Sam, same thing.
Sam Fogarino.
I'm from Philly, but I was kind of up and down the East Coast trying to find something, you know? I'd been playing in a band in Miami for about 5 years, and I was kind of heartbroken that nothing ever really panned out aside from a couple 7-inch singles and a full length that was kind of a little too late. So I traveled around, and eventually, in 97, landed in Brooklyn with about $50 in my pocket and all my worldly possessions in a car. It was a Ford Escort.
Paul Banks.
We parted ways with our first drummer without knowing who our second drummer would be.
Sam Fogarino.
The path to serendipity was led by this guy Doug Henderson, who was a recording engineer. He pulled me aside and said, I can see you're frustrated as hell. Daniel's band just recorded and their drummer sucks. Doug got me the tape, and I thought it was really good, but it just didn't hit me. It was about 2 years later, in 2000, that Daniel and I met up again, and he gave me what is commonly referred to as the Great EP. It was just an EP with hot pink lettering in that Interpol Helvetica font. And it was recorded at the Rare Book Room. I thought, oh my god, this is good. It still had the roots of punk in there, but there was a lot of atmosphere, and Paul's lyrics just got my attention. I was like, here it is. This is it. We met up once before the first rehearsal, briefly, for a drink. I remember Daniel saying, and trying to be as kind as possible, but saying, Carlos is very sarcastic and arrogant. And Paul is very cold and distant. Don't let it bother you.
Paul Banks.
Carlos is an intense and very complicated guy. He's inflexible. So that creates tension right there. And Daniel is very mild manner, but he's got a game plan. He's got a long view. He's got an overarching concept. He's got his goals, but he's very tight-lipped. And then I'm more of a sloppy, loose person. Which I think in some ways is repulsive to other people who are more rigid and inflexible.
Sam Fogarino.
At this point in time, I was used to jumping into the fray, used to arriving at the party well after it started, so I could be a loner for a little while.
Daniel Kessler.
The first rehearsal with Sam was instant magic.
Paul Banks.
I just remember when he hit the kick drum, I could sense the precision. Tight, powerful, and precise. And he looked cool. Sam also brought a dap to that first rehearsal. And he made the best recording we ever heard of the band. One of the songs was The New. My parents were in Spain at that time, so on my college summer break I went home to Spain and I had this cassette. I remember playing it to this girl that I was hanging out with at the time. I was so excited about what we were doing. I wanted people near me to hear it. She didn't get it.
Sam Fogarino.
I was looking for Interpol, but I didn't know it.
Daniel Kessler.
Being a band in New York is fun, but it's not fun. It's expensive and you're broke and everyone is scrounging for money, and you get your rehearsal space for an hour or two and your equipment is all broken. So you spend your first hour saying, the thing's broken. That was a very hard time. We spent 4 years without having anyone pay any attention. It was like being in the minor leagues. But it gave us time to develop. By the time we did get attention, we were solidified and had our foundation, and it was very hard for an outside force to penetrate that. Chapter 24. Anarchy in the UK. Jimmy Goodwin. The Strokes were one of those bands that people saw and then instantly wanted to form a band.
Laura Young. It just has to be the perfect cross-section of right place, right time, right music, right image. April Long. I was in the NME office the day that James Endicott, the wild-haired, roving party maker from Rough Trade, brought in the Strokes demo to play. I said, "Oh, that's the band I saw in New York at Don Hills. I have a picture of that guy's butt." He brought it in, played it, then left, and James Oldham put something else on. We were sitting there, and then James said, "Let's listen to that demo again." We basically never took it off.
Ryan Gentles. There was one song on the radio, The Modern Age. It was all based on that song, and this photo Leslie Lyons took that ran in the NME.
Leslie Lyons. We shot one of those Wednesday nights in December 2000 at the Mercury Lounge residency. My assistant and I watched the show, and then I got right behind the camera and began shooting. That first night, we shot until 2 or 3 a.m. in the tiny room off the bar in Mercury Lounge. I wanted them the minute they stepped off stage. Afterward, we moved locations to Café Noir in Soho. I can't overstate the strength of their personalities, really. Their shadows have more personality than most people.
Ryan Gentles. She took pictures the second night of the residency and sent them right over to Jeff. It was the classic picture of them hanging around, all fucked up. That picture is, in our history, kind of famous. And as soon as those pictures ran in NME, that was it. It was that photo, them being from New York and their names. They all had cool fucking names.
Jeanette Lee. I remember that first day we heard their CD, we were calling out the names like, "Is this a real name? These are rock star names, they can't be true." Could it possibly be that they looked good as well? They did.
Vito Roccaforte. English indie rock was just boring. There were all these post-Radiohead bands. Everybody in indie rock was trying to be Radiohead, but there's only one Radiohead. Dave Gottlieb. We're talking about a time when Coldplay was considered alternative. Connor McNicholas. Post-Britpop, there was this terrible Netherland that was filled with Travis and Coldplay. Steve Sutherland described NME readers as being the stinky kid in the school playground with the big parka on who you didn't want to speak to. Suddenly, when the Strokes turned up, we were the cool kids again.
Kelly Kiley. They arrived on a wet January morning, got out of the bus, and it was just like, "Oh my goodness, they are here." They just looked so cool.
Ryan Gentles. We first went to the UK in January of 2001.
Kelly Kiley. Even from that first time they stepped off the bus, they were stinky. Albert, not so much, or Nikolai, but the others just stunk. There was too much partying to be had to clean your clothes. They wore the same clothes all the time. Kimya Dawson. They were all younger than me, so I was kind of the mom, and I remember saying to them, "Don't you want to remember this shit?" And they were just like, "Woohoo, party mode." Kelly Kiley. It was funny because they were also sophisticated, like they made fun of the English food. There were no good sushi bars.
Julian Casablancas. We hung out with all the Rough Trade people. We were friends with them.
Jeanette Lee. Julian has always seemed to be struggling with himself. Kelly Kiley. That first day we took them into the Rough Trade shop. It was raining and they were inappropriately dressed. No thick coats, just thin denim and leather jackets. Then we went out that night. I just remember standing at a pinball machine with Julian and him telling me all about his stepfather. Just really complex, in-depth stuff.
Jeff Travis. Julian's not comfortable.
Jeanette Lee. He's uncomfortable with himself. He's always like, do you think I'm an asshole? I'm an asshole.
Jeff Travis. Don't talk to me. I'm an idiot.
Jeanette Lee. He's always struggling with communication.
Jeff Travis. But at the same time, that is a major brain calculating every single thing.
Jeanette Lee. Julian is incredibly affectionate when he's not being standoffish. I mean, there's so much hugging and kissing all the time. English people are very reserved. They're like, hello. He's like, come here. Julian is this big bear. It's kind of shocking.
Ryan Gentles. We did a few club shows and they all sold out.
Kelly Kiley. There had been all this hype. Jeanette and Jeff had just gone to see them in New York, and literally 6 weeks later, they're here in freezing cold January. People were just fawning over them.
Kelly Okereke. Around that time, NME had a free CD on its cover that included The Modern Age. That was the first thing that I heard and thought, hey, this is cool.
Leslie Lyons. By the time the Strokes hit the stage, they were already superstars. Their pictures were all over the English press, and their shows were backing up what people were seeing in the pictures. Nothing was left behind in New York. The look, the sound, the energy was presented in full force. It's like the Mercury Lounge residency was a big bang, and the particles just started spreading far and wide at an accelerated speed. April Long. The big show was at the Astoria.
Kelly Okereke. I saw the Strokes at the Astoria with Peaches and Trail of Dead. They were on second, and it didn't feel like anybody knew who they were. I don't know what anyone was expecting, but by the end of it, I was completely like, who are these guys?
April Long. They went on to completely take over that tour. None of the other bands were talked about afterward. They were fucking fantastic. I remember Fab, who was, what, 19 or something then? I remember he had a phone number. His mother's, I think, but it could have been a tour manager's. Pinned to the inside of his jacket in case he got lost. I mean, that's what they were like.
Albert Hammond Jr. When you first start, it's not even money. No one was like, what hotel are we staying at? It was like, we're going to England to play music? This is everything already.
Kelly Kiley. The night at the Barfly was also big. It's a really small venue, but there must have been about 20,000 people there, if everyone who says they were there actually came. Julian was sick before the show, then went on and just nailed it. Jeanette Lee. That was their moment in London.
Russell Warby. They were tremendous. It was a tiny room, but they absolutely took it over. Afterward, we all piled into the back of this van they had and went back to Columbia Hotel, where they were staying. The really peculiar thing is all of these people that were in the van, including me, were serenading the Strokes with these songs that we'd just heard. We'd heard them once or twice, and were now singing them all back to the band. They just sort of sat there stunned.
Kelly Kiley. You can get rooms for five at the Columbia. We were arranging for them to come over in January, and one of the things that sticks out in my head was Ryan saying, I can stay in the same room as them. I was thinking, this is weird. Why is this old dude in the same room as them? He must have picked up, and he said, you do know I'm the same age as them, don't you?
Russell Warby. At the Columbia, we had quite a lot to drink, and people fell asleep, including me. I fell asleep sort of propped up against the bed. I remember waking up, maybe sort of 4 in the morning, and seeing Nikolai in bed with a big smile on his face, and his boots still on. Jim Merlis. I went over to London for those shows. No one paid for me to go, I just wanted to be there. And I stayed at the Columbia Hotel. I remember getting a call in my room. This was before they'd played, just after we'd all arrived and were settling in. I went up there, and it was the six of them, Ryan too. They're all in a bed watching TV. It kind of stank, real boy odor. They were all barefoot in bed together, and they smelled like rock stars. They said,
We just want to tell you, we want to do this for the rest of our lives. It was so sweet.
Chapter 25 Party in a Bag.
Karen O. The beauty of New York, the genius of New York, is that you can leave your house and run into someone and hang out with them. And then they take you to the next place, and you run into other people, and before you know it, you have a posse. And you're launching into the night until 4 in the morning on some adventure. That aspect of New York, which is the most genius part of the city, is what it feels like to be in a band in New York. You collect your crew as you go along, in a seemingly random way, but there's something that connects you. And the criteria for that something is pretty minimal. Which is also the beauty of being young.
Nick Zinner. I used to call Karen a party in a bag. Like, oh, we should totally invite Karen. She'll set the party on. She had this infectious, super wild, didn't give a fuck, awesome, fun, silly thing. Dave Siddick. Karen can rage, and everyone's invited. Nick Zinner. New York, when I moved here, was awful because everyone was so serious and cool and into heroin. All the bands were dark and serious. We had our dark band. Unitard was super dark. But that lightness, that silliness, was inside us. And Karen was an expert in bringing it out and embodying it. We really needed that. And New York needed that, too.
Karen O. I was all about getting free and causing trouble. All I wanted to do was cause trouble. Like, if I had a night where I didn't cause trouble, I'd be really disappointed in myself. I lived for it.
Dave Siddick. The most drunk I've ever been in my life is definitely with Karen. And the most trouble I've ever gotten into in my adult life is probably with Karen. And the most fun I've had has probably been with Karen. It's just her ability to defend the sandbox against the adults. She defends the right to just be creative and follow your bliss.
Karen O. I had a lot of buddies who were just as into causing trouble as I was. Christian Joy might be the primary one. I had a couple of girlfriends who would just get kicked out of everywhere, just fuck with the wrong people. But they were the right people because they were asking to be fucked with. Christian Joy. She can be this normal, shy woman who's in the kitchen cooking food, and you don't have any impression that she might be this amazing performer. And then, all of a sudden, the other side of her comes out. Karen has this dual personality.
Mark Spitz. I first interviewed Yaya Yaz at some douchebaggery bar on the corner of Fifth Avenue and Houston Street, where people go for, like, chicken wings and blood transfusions. It was like, why are we meeting there? It was Nick, it was Brian the drummer, and then this skinny, frail-looking mousy chick in a blue hoodie pulled all the way over her head. I thought, who's this? And then I realized, oh, it's Karen. She's acting absolutely nothing like the sort of microphone blowjob-giving, beer-spitting Karen O that she is on stage. Which is, you know, what happens. You have this persona. You don't live that way. Asif Ahmed. Offstage, she's like a librarian, painfully shy and private. I would actually make fun of her about it, like, no one wants to know what you do offstage anyways because you're fucking boring. There was nothing to report.
Karen O. At my elementary school, we had to do a lip-sync performance of Wild Thing. It was a small, private school. There were probably 17 of us in the entire grade, and out of that, there were 4 or 5 girls. I was the lead singer. The girls wore poodle skirts, and I was the boy. I slicked my hair back, and I wore these sunglasses that were so dark I couldn't see out of them. I got up there, and I just went nuts. I was pretty unaware of the audience watching, the kids, the teachers watching. It actually did freak a lot of the teachers out, and probably the kids, too. I was a goofy kid, but I was pretty mild-mannered. And then it was like this thing came out. So, there were glimpses leading up to when I got on stage with Yaya Yaz for the first time.
Rob Sheffield. Karen probably told you that the impetus for Yaya Yaz was that she was always going to indie rock shows and people were sitting on the floor.
She was like, I hate that.
Nick Zinner. At some point, Karen was like, let's start a rock band. My reaction was, ugh, why? We had this cool thing here with Unitard. We're playing these great haunting ballads. I was playing slide guitar. They're really cool songs. But she was like, no, dude, trust me, dude. She used to talk like a 17-year-old valley girl, or valley boy, actually. Dude, dude, come on, dude. I started to get into the idea. We started telling everyone, we're going to start a rock band, and we're going to be fucking awesome. Asif Ahmed. I was kind of the only younger manager at the time. Everyone else was 180 years old. I was also the East Village barfly. Three sips of alcohol and I'm like, let me tell you something about the music business. Meanwhile, I'm 23. Nick Zinner. One night Karen and I were in my loft with a drum machine. We drank Brass Monkeys and literally in 2 hours wrote four songs. And two or three of them were on our first EP. Bang was the first song we wrote. After that, our bar bragging was validated, and it was also heightened. We came up with a name a week later. We were at some bar on Avenue A. We overheard someone just saying, yeah, 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 to someone else, and that was it. We had a name. We were telling everyone how badass we were. Eventually, we knew we were going to have to play some songs.
Rennie Elliott. In the beginning, it was Karen, Nick, Jack Martin, also on guitar, and me.
Nick Zinner. There was a month and a half that Karen and I played with different people.
Rennie Elliott. I'm not sure why exactly they asked me. We were good friends, but I really wasn't a great drummer.
Nick Zinner. We tried playing with a keyboard player, but none of these things were working. It was a nightmare, just really, really hard.
Rennie Elliott. The first practices were at Tucaso Studios. Karen and Nick came with the song ideas, and Jack and I joined in. They had already decided on the name and had some of the songs that were on the first album. Karen and Nick were best buds and had a very strong, creative musical connection from the start.
Nick Zinner. It was all taking a long time. And then our friend Dave was like, hey, you guys are always talking about your band that no one has ever heard of. Do you want to open up for the White Stripes at Mercury Lounge? Chapter 26. I don't know who was paying for the drugs. It wasn't me. Ryan Gentles. The Modern Age EP came out in the UK on Rough Trade January 29, 2001. Basically right at the end of that mini-tour. While we were in the UK, Doves asked us to open for them as main support on their upcoming US tour, which was going to be in February-March. So when we got home, we went on tour supporting them. Dave Gottlieb. In the 1990s, RCA was a cemetery, but they had turned it around. They had Dave Matthews Band, Christina Aguilera, The Verve Pipe. I got there right as Christina was exploding. They had rebuilt themselves by having a couple of one-off hits like the Macarena that brought in revenue. Ryan Gentles. Jeff Travis offered to give us 15K tour support to do the Doves shows, which was amazing, as he didn't have us for the US territory at all. It was just on the condition that we pay the label back once we got signed in America, which of course we did. By that time, we were well embroiled in negotiations with RCA. Dave Gottlieb. When I got handed the Strokes' single by Steve Ralbovsky, he said, I want you to come see this band. They're playing at the Bowery opening for the Doves. I listened to the single and I went, okay, this is different. I went to the show. I remember them coming out and ripping through three songs. I grabbed Ralbovsky, who was standing in front of me, and said, any major label that signs this band is on crack. He was like, I don't understand, you don't like it? I'm like, no, it's fucking great. But this is not what we do. Brian Long. When I was at MCA, I had the second big meeting with them. I took them to a Chinese restaurant on the Bowery right below Canal. We had a big round table. And they were real smartasses in a very entertaining way. It
They were very impress us, and it was hard. We had Blink 182, you know? Dave Gottlieb. I mean, the show was as fresh and memorable as any. It was probably one of the top five rock shows I've seen in my life. Right there in that room at that moment, they were seizing their opportunity. They were looking like no other band out there. But that's a problem. At major labels, it's about following. How can we follow doing what somebody else has already succeeded doing? Not how do we cut a new path? And RCA, despite having the Foo Fighters and cutting somewhat of a path with Christina Aguilera, still was not confident enough to think, you know what? We've got the fucking Clash, and we're going to make this happen. This is the future of rock and roll. That's what it would take. And that's why I was saying any record label would be on crack. Because they would be trying to break what their livelihood was. Brian Long. They didn't sound like radio. The radio sounded like rap rock. But that was what was great about them. Because things change. You know, radio changes. Dave Gottlieb. You could tell that if you got it right with the Strokes, it would make a certain type of music irrelevant. Something else on your roster that has been vibrant and important, it would be gone. Something like the Strokes is going to be shocking in the same way that grunge was shocking to the world of hair bands. Brian Long. Of course I wanted to sign them. But you know what I was told? They don't sound like the radio. Go find something else. I took them out in January of 2001, and it was probably in April 2001. I get a call from the president of MCA, and he goes, "You're the one that was telling us about that band The Strokes from New York, right?" I was like, "Yeah." "You told me you didn't think they sounded like the radio, so I stopped pursuing them." "Think you can get them still?" That's one of the fallacies of that structure. It often doesn't reward foresight. Ryan Gentles. The RCA guys had actually flown out to Toronto to see the band on that Doves tour. That's when Steve Ralbovsky and Jack Rovner made their big impression. Steve Ralbovsky. Their prior experience with label representatives had put them off. People were asking them about what they did in their spare time. They wanted to know more about the band's relationship with John Casablancas. They wanted to be chummy and show how cool they could be. We weren't really showing up to show off. And Jack delivered a youthful head of company articulateness. Dave Gottlieb. The Strokes loved Jack because he never said no. And he responded to Ryan and the band whenever something was up. He wasn't doing that with everyone. Steve Ralbovsky. And I think they liked a lot of the bands that I had signed and worked with in my day, back to the Beastie Boys and Rick Rubin. Ryan Gentles. By the time we returned from that tour, we knew it was RCA's deal to fuck up. Nick Valenci. The signing experience was very exciting. Dinners, drugs, expensive wine. I don't know who was paying for the drugs, it wasn't me. You're sitting with people who have what seems like an endless expense account to basically do whatever you want. And their job is to impress you and to show you a good time. I certainly took advantage of that. We were still in a van at this point, showing up to dinner in Converse and jeans you've been wearing for a month. We would choose the restaurants. We'd sit down and ask for the wine list, pick out expensive wine, sometimes to the horror of the people who were there with you. It was really fun. We were kind of at the tail end of the over-the-top record label excesses. Ryan Gentles. I didn't choose the label, but I did do this. I said, "I like Interscope, I like Epic, and I like RCA." I broke down to negotiations to see who I could get, and I was pitting them against each other to see who would give us what I wanted out of a deal, because all Julian knows is he wants to make records. I knew that I wanted to own Is This It, the first record, and I asked the three labels, "Can we own this record? I don't want to give it to you. You can release it, but we want to own it." Two said no, and one said yes, and that's who we signed with. All the other deal points were identical. We might have even taken a little less from RCA on some deal points because I wanted the record. We own it. We can release it if we want. Anniversary edition. It's all ours. We can put it out on our own label. It belongs to us.
Not even Elvis or the Beatles own their records. Dave Gottlieb. You felt a groundswell happening that summer of 2001. They did a dozen or so dates with the Doves, and they were selling out everywhere they played. Then they'd go play a 200-seat club in Philly on a Wednesday night, and it is packed. And people are going bonkers, and you're going, there's no record out. How are you finding this? This is where this band's story is different from those before. Because this is where the internet comes into play. People have CDs they're burning and passing to each other. That was already happening. Ryan Gentles. After the Doves dates in February-March, we got offered 4 or 5 support slots opening up for Guided by Voices, which was a dream come true for the guys. Albert Hammond Jr. They were my favorite band, so we were just excited. And it became a big influence on our sound for our first record, really. More so than people give them credit for. More than Television, I'll tell you that. I hadn't even heard of Television. I'd maybe heard about them, but I never investigated. I just knew, oh yeah, that guy Verlaine, or whatever. Steve Ralbovsky. I managed Tom Verlaine for a while. They were more impressed that I signed Ween. Julian Casablancas. The dream for me was to be in a band like Guided by Voices or Built to Spill, and just be big enough to have a fan base and be able to do it for a living. That was the goal, and there wasn't anything beyond that. Nick Valenci. No one at any point ever said, I want my song to be on the radio, or I want to sign to a major record label. I want to go headline the Reading Festival. No one was thinking that. We didn't even fucking talk about those things, but in my mind, I would have been happy if we could just get to that Guided by Voices indie level of success. If we could tour clubs and do this for the next 10 or 20 years, I'd have been happy as a fucking clam. I'm telling you, I'm not an ambitious person. I'm not. Fabrizio Moretti. Bullshit. We were ambitious. The several levels of Dante's Inferno that we had to go through emotionally within the band to be able to stick to it was crazy. That's ambition. That's like the definition of ambition. Even beyond what is mechanically necessary for you to survive in this world, you emotionally and psychologically need to want it. That's why people revere athletes. It's almost self-preservation to say we didn't care that much. Ryan Gentles. The Strokes continued to record from the time they got back from those GBV support slots in early spring all the way through the summer, well before the deal with RCA was even done. We were recording the album anyway, using money from a publishing deal with Warner Chappell that we signed earlier in the year. Not that we needed a lot. I think the whole album cost about $20,000 all in, not including the advance paid to Gordon, of course, which came from the label eventually. Gordon Raphael. We recorded Is This It between March and April 2001 at Transporterium in Alphabet City. Mark Ronson. I had my recording studio on 2nd between A and B, which was where the Strokes recorded that first album. There were these jazz guys. They had 2 other rooms in the basement. They said, I hope you're a little better a neighbor than the last kids we had. And I said, who are they? This fucking band, these kids. There were pizza boxes everywhere, beer, their friends coming in. They're making massive amounts of noise. And I asked, what were they called? And he said, The Strokes. At that point, I didn't know any of those guys, but they already were heroes. I was like, are you fucking kidding? Do you not know who The Strokes are? Ryan Gentles. I remember watching Mallrats a lot in the basement. I remember Gordon smoking a lot of weed, sometimes freaking out because Julian wanted to go 16 straight hours in the studio. He was always very driven. Gordon Raphael. They were a little pickier than I was used to. Julian Casablancas. Gordon just had the right ingredients for us. We tried to do the same songs with other people and they sounded totally stale. Gordon is the king of understanding abstract information. You'd get further by saying, could you make it sound more yellow? Than you could saying, take out the bottom end or something. He'd get it. Ryan Gentles. Gordon is such a great interpreter of musicians.
Julian won't say that hi-hat is too trebly, turn the bass up or the treble down. He'll say, I need the hi-hat to sound like the rich guy who hangs out at the party and doesn't talk to girls, waits for them to come and talk to him. And Gordon is like, okay. That's almost verbatim how I've heard him describe a hi-hat sound. It's too much like the way a sleeping bum smells on a Friday night when he's had too much booze. I don't want it to smell like that. Gussy it up and shave him. That's the snare drum sound I want. He talks in analogies like that, and Gordon understands them. Albert Hammond Jr. Julian had stressful moments, and so did Gordon. But for me, I felt like it was going to happen. So I let it go a little bit. I believed in it. I'd listened to the songs we were doing with Gordon, and they'd all just gel. This was when everything was fun. We had the songs, we knew what we wanted to do, we had the right person, we had the momentum. You're not thinking. Your gut just feels it. Chapter 27. Just trust me. Har Mar Superstar. I used to go to the White Stripes early shows in Minneapolis, so we kind of knew each other. I'd just get wasted and hang out. At some point, Jack started calling me Minibar. That's my nickname, Minibar Superstar. Hey, Minibar! They were always really good. They were always amazing. The White Stripes had that thing where everybody in the audience wants to fuck one or both of them. Kid Congo Powers. The big deal was the White Stripes at that time. And their booking agent, Dave Kaplan, was also booking us. Dave Burton. David Kaplan was an old friend of mine. We were at Mars Bar one night, and he said, I need an opener. I said, I'll get you Yeah Yeah Yeahs to do it. Dave said, what's Yeah Yeah Yeahs? And I said, Nick and that girl at the end of the bar over there. Dave also knew Nick from the bar, so he was like, oh, I like Nick. And that was that. Dave Kaplan. Dave asked, so I put them on. They were the first of four. Zach Lippez. It was Yeah Yeah Yeahs, my band, Ryan Gentles, the Candy Darlings. Remember them?
Karen O. They were friends of ours.
Zach Lippez. Then Kid Congo and the White Stripes. Kid Congo Powers. I met the White Stripes that day. Jack White. He was working at a vintage store nearby, and Meg and I happened to stop in there. Kid Congo Powers. Cherry, on Orchard Street. The White Stripes came in. They were eyeing these red and white 50s striped, of course, old men's bathing suits, which would have been worn as hot pants, kind of Speedo-like, but more 50s looking. I was like, oh, you are the White Stripes. Because I had seen their publicity photo for the show, and it was very clear they were who they were. They were wearing red and white at the time, always red pants and a white shirt, or vice versa. Jack White. We were very excited to meet someone from the Gun Club. We didn't know he'd also been in the Cramps. Kid Congo Powers. They were a little geeked out. They were pretty shy at the time. They were really young. They were fans of Gun Club and other stuff I had done. They were very respectful and really nice. And we ended up doing a lot more shows with them. Became friendly.
Chloe Walsh. I was the White Stripes publicist at the time, and they were in New York, but they didn't have a hotel. They were sleeping on sofas. I couldn't think of anywhere that they could go and do photo shoots and interviews, so I said, would you mind? We could do this at my apartment. They said, no, that's fine. I had two cats, and Jack was ghastly allergic, but he didn't say anything. So by the end of the day, he was, like, all puffy. But I remember, I had the Strokes EP because I loved it, and Jack saw it, and he had never heard them, but people were asking him about them in interviews, so he put it on. His reaction was along the lines of, that's it, three songs? Meg was not remotely interested. Jack complained a lot about New York. He hated it. He still hates it. He was wearing his red pants and a white t-shirt, and he asked me to find a Sharpie, and he had Meg write on his t-shirt, "New York confuses me." We went outside to the bottom of my street on Ludlow and Canal and had their picture taken with the Twin Towers behind them and "New York confuses me" on the t-shirt. Those were their early press shots.
Zach Lipez. I really loved the White Stripes album, and I wanted to become friends with them. It was clear that we weren't going to become friends. Harmar Superstar. Yeah, it just depends on your relationship with him. To some people, Jack is a total crazed maniac, but he's never been to me. To me, he's always been a goofball. Nick Zinner. I don't think we knew who the White Stripes were.
Karen O. I knew who they were. A friend of a friend introduced me to the Distill record, and I really liked it.
Nick Zinner. Rennie, our drummer, couldn't make it because, like every other musician in 2000, she played in four bands.
Rennie Elliott. I was in three other bands and working full-time and seriously getting into playing the banjo.
Nick Zinner. There was this very specific moment I remember outside my loft. I suggested we just play as Unitard. The White Stripes gig was a week away. I was certain there was no way we could get a drummer. Karen just said, "No, dude, my friend Brian from Oberlin just moved down here. He'll learn everything. He can play with us." Brian Chase. I think she must have called me on the phone, because that's what people did. She probably called me at my parents' house. She had to talk to my mom. "Hey, is Brian there?" I grew up on Long Island in Huntington, and when I finished Oberlin, I moved in with them, the parents. I was technically still living with my parents. Nick Zinner. Karen said, "Just trust me." So I did. We had one practice with him. Brian Chase. She gave me a cassette tape and I learned the songs. Nick Zinner. Some people assume that I'm responsible for all the instrumental music. I would just like to clarify that when we're writing and trying to come up with stuff, Karen is not just standing there with a microphone.
Karen O. We are all over and under acknowledged, or acknowledged maybe for the wrong things. Like, Nick is obviously the best looking in the band.
Nick Zinner. Brian is a great beer spitter.
Karen O. I write a mean bass line and keyboard line.
Zach Lipez. I remember loving the White Stripes, and I loved Kid Congo. He's a charmer. Kid Congo Powers. I knew Nick already. He'd been hanging around with my band Knoxville Girls. He had coincidentally been in Europe when the Knoxville Girls were on tour in Europe, traveling by himself. And one day we were in Amsterdam driving down the street, and we see Nick Zinner walking down the street with a big baguette. Even then he had that hair. He looked like his hair was going very fast. Like he was going very fast and his hair was following. So we said, "Nick, get in the van with us. We have these dates in Holland." He was our road crew for a few days. I knew Nick was a rock star by looking at him, but he was a very quiet young man. I didn't get a lot of information out of him. I knew Nick had a band, and I had heard from a friend that it was good, so I was excited for the show. Dave Kaplan. I want to say it was kind of sloppy, but whose first show wouldn't be? Nick Zinner. Brian's snare broke, so we had to borrow Meg White's snare drum. I remember they were nice, but when we were setting up, Jack was really bummed that there was another band without a bass player that was opening up for them. Jack White. A lot of times I would say things out loud that for people who don't know me well might make them think I'm extremely concerned about something because of the sound of my voice. It's usually just me thinking out loud. I talk to myself too much, too. Kid Congo Powers. The White Stripes were the start of the duo. Now the duo is everywhere, but then not so much. No duo was particularly popular, especially playing rock music. No one was able to pull it off. Jack White. Our band's problem in the early years was that local promoters would say,
"Oh, wouldn't it be cute to put our local two-piece band on there to open for them?" Or, "The White Stripes must hate the bass. Let's book a band that has no bass to warm up." Any of our reactions had nothing to do with whether we liked whatever band or their music or not. It was about us not wanting to be lumped in with anyone else, wanting to stand out whenever we could, trying to push forward. So yeah, when we roll into Blah Blah Blah, Ohio, and there would be a no-bass band with a girl on drums booked to play with us, we'd say, "Of course." We always wished for a band that was the exact opposite of us so that we could have a contrast. But we also, of course, loved playing with like-minded people, and Yeah Yeah Yeahs definitely were. We should have been better friends back then. We were a lot alike, but we didn't get to see them enough because of the touring. Kid Congo Powers. I had no idea what the show would be like, and I don't really remember what the music was like. I remember Karen. Dave Kaplan. Karen always had stage presence, that's for sure.
Karen O. I had a plan. I wanted to go up there looking like a sweaty punk rock star. I was wearing these wide bell-bottom pants with a white wife beater. I didn't wear a bra. I cut out these hearts that I wore as pasties underneath the white wife beater. My plan was to douse myself in olive oil before I went on stage. I thought if the oil kind of seeped in, it would be a little bit sexy, but it just looked like I had humongous nipples.
Kid Congo Powers. After the show, I turned to whoever was next to me and I said, "Wow, something is happening here. She's already fully formed and she is there. This is their first show and she's already all there. She's totally unself-conscious. I don't even know if she knows that she's going for it or not, and that's the beauty of it. And it's not unnatural. I don't think she's rehearsed this, but I think it's just happening." She was completely in the moment. And that's all you can really ask from a singer. Nick Zinner. From the beginning, it was definitely her spotlight. My feelings on that are mixed because I don't like being in the spotlight, so I was happy. But also saw how totally fucking intense it was for her. It's a lead singer thing. She's amazing, born to do it, or whatever it is parents say. Kid Congo Powers. Of course, the White Stripes were great too. It was clean. They were already fully formed too, in a different kind of way. It was like, wow, that kid Jack can play the guitar really well.
Karen O. I was kind of hoping that the White Stripes would catch us. I must have drunk like 4 or 5 margaritas before I went on, and we went on really early. I was really nervous. But I was also pumped. I was ready. You know, when you have that hope that someone else is watching you, you really want to pull out all the stops.
Jack White. I loved that show and was very impressed with Yeah Yeah Yeahs. I love strong females in music very much. And when I saw Nick on guitar, I remember I wished I was the same size as him physically. Thomas Honorato. That's one of the only moments in my life where I'll be able to say I was there. More so than any other time with a music artist. When I saw Karen O on stage at Mercury Lounge, I was like, "Oh, you're gonna be famous. Oh, you've got it. I get it." Jack White. That was one of the best New York crowds we had back then at that show. Kid Congo Powers. The crowd was a mix. The White Stripes were there, and you knew it was just the very beginning for them. There were a lot of industry people, and also there were a lot of kids, a lot of young people. I remember saying, "I feel like a really dirty old man up here." Jack White. For some reason, I think PJ Harvey and Vincent Gallo were backstage. We took a photo with them. I asked what the name of this new band we were in this photo together was, and Vince said, "Hopeless." Kid Congo Powers. I knew with the White Stripes something was going to happen. That was very obvious. I've been around the block. I've been around a long time, I could see. With Yeah Yeah Yeahs, the music was pretty crazy, so I wasn't sure. But I did think Karen is already a completely unself-conscious, fully made rock star. She's up there, doesn't give a fuck, is fantastic and in the moment. That was not something you see.
People are self-conscious. People are calculated. But she was just there. Present. Boom. Nick Zinner. I think Jack White stayed at Karen's house after.
Karen O. Yeah, he played Super Mario Kart or something.
Jack White. A girl and I